Now, it's a true delight to be speaking with distinguished actor Peter Bowles. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Now, there aren't many actors like yourself who can turn their hand not only to playing classic drama on stage, but also playing villains on film and comedy roles. You've done it all. Also, few actors today can boast they're in a series that regularly drew in millions of viewers. But that's what you achieved with the BBC series To the Manor Born. Did you have an inkling when offered that part it would become such a landmark TV series?
No, not at all. The funny thing about it is that I was offered The Good Life, which I turned down. And then when I was offered To the Manor Born, my agent turned it down. because I was very busy doing Rumpole of the Bailey. But anyway, I decided that I wasn't going to miss another opportunity. So I managed to organise rehearsals close to each other and rehearsed one show in the morning and another in the afternoon. But, of course, we had no idea it was going to be such a massive hit. Massive hit. No.
Yeah, absolutely. I bet your agents had a few choice words for your agent on that day. But it all worked out for the best. Now, of course, many US listeners listening into the show will remember just how popular To the Manor Born was in the States. But you did, of course, go over to Broadway with the renowned Old Vic Company, so revered in the US. What's your enduring memory of Broadway, and did you ever consider living in America?
Well, my memories of Broadway are all the shows I saw, the musicals and things, flirting with Maggie Smith, who was on stage there in another show, and going on for a while, because I was an understudy, in Troilus and Cressida. And I know that when I left America after 6 months, I think I was 20 by then, I was 19 when I went. I thought, if this plane crashes, I've had a wonderful life. It was a great time.
Wonderful experience, isn't it? Now, of course, you are a man of good taste in so many areas, but I understand you've always been a fan of Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent, and you actually saw them performing on stage. That must have been quite an electric atmosphere.
Yes, it was. Unfortunately, it was their last performance that I saw. Because, I don't know, Gene Vincent's, but Eddie Cochran's, because he died that night. But it was the most extraordinary thing about Cochran was that his voice, for a man so young, I think he was 22, something like that, was so full of character and alpha male masculinity. And, he was very sexy indeed. I also discovered that at one point there was a strange moment where Gene Vincent invited one of his backing group to come forward and got him to kneel down. And whilst he sang this song, he ruffled this man's hair, blonde hair, rather homoerotic way, I thought at the time. And it turned out, I found out years later, because I did a film with him, it was Joe Brown. Who's still going, who's still rocking.
Yes, absolutely, yes. I think he's on tour quite
he
locally
is.
Near us.
Wonderful.
So, yeah, it's great stuff, isn't it?
I know how old he is, because he must be my age.
We won't say anything.
No.
But of course, I mean, it's wonderful. Everybody does connect in such a way, don't they? I mean, on stage you've appeared with many names, and in the company of the Old Vic you appeared with Claire Bloom, Dame Judi Dench, Charles Grey, to name but a few. But you also had the good fortune to watch many a star from the wings, like Laurence Olivier, Burt Lancaster and Richard Attenborough. What would you say you learnt most from working and watching these individuals?
I think the most important thing you learn from them is their confidence. Is their self-belief. And in every single name you've mentioned, the way they treated other actors, which was always with enormous friendliness.
That's very unique, isn't it? I mean, I understand when you met Laurence Olivier, he gave you some stagecraft tips to get the best applause. That must have been quite invaluable.
Yes, he did, and also revealed. He also revealed, part of his character when I said, well, because he advised me to exit at a certain spot on the stage, and he said, of course, you will get a round of applause wherever you exit, but if you exit here, your round of applause will be even greater. And I said, well, thank you very much, sir. I'm not exiting there because you come on after me, which he did, and that's where you come on from. And he put his arm round me and he said, my dear boy, don't worry about me. I can come on from anywhere. He's very nice.
It's that confidence you were talking about, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes,
supreme confidence.
Yeah.
Now, of course, years later, you appeared and you played the part of Archie Rice, made famous by Laurence Olivier,
when
you played it in 1986 at the Shaftesbury Theatre. Were you apprehensive about stepping into Olivier's shoes?
I wasn't. Because I had John Osborne on my side, who I discovered was someone who admired my work. He'd seen me at the Royal Court in 1960. But it was the attitude of other people, because I had been doing a great deal of television. Situation comedies, which had been enormously successful, Only When I Laugh and The Bounder and things like that, people didn't believe that I could do The Entertainer. In my case, that always just makes me more determined to show them.
Yeah.
Because I was the first person after Olivier to do it in London. So it was quite a, challenge.
Yes.
In that way.
Yes.
But otherwise, no. I had managed to get the confidence that I had seen in some of the names that you mentioned.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? But of course, you have had such an extensive background of theatre work, and I remember, as well as having many happy hours watching you on the television over the years, I very much enjoyed your playing of Molière's The Misanthrope, and also I loved seeing you alongside the late, great Eric Sykes in the Peter Hall production of the Molière School for Wives. Did you enjoy working on that and working with Eric Sykes?
Yes. Yes, I did. More particularly, I enjoyed working with Sir Peter Hall. He turned my whole life around. I'd done quite a lot of television, and it's very difficult if you've done television to get back into the theatre. And he saw me in a film, which in fact I had managed to set up and get the money for, and had asked Simon Gray if he would, be involved and write. And he wrote a most wonderful script, and it's called Running Late. Anyway, it was a film, and Peter Hall saw it, and I'd never met him. I mean, I'd been trying to get into the National Theatre and Stratford all my life, but there's a strange snobbery which goes on, which is that, if you do a lot of television, or certainly comedy, then you're not quite a proper stage actor. I always remember a huge headline. I can't remember when this would have been, probably in the 60s or early 70s, when Edward Woodward went to the National Theatre, and the headline in the Evening Standard was, TV actor to join the National Theatre. I mean, extraordinary.
Yeah.
But anyway, Peter Hall bumped into me in the street, and he'd seen it the night before, and he said he'd very much like to work with me, and so I was thrilled, and in fact have done 12 plays that he's directed.
wonderful rapport that you have with...
Changed my life.
Yes, yeah. It's wonderful. Very much actors and directors, when they find a collaboration, it's a wonderful thing. Now, I understand, whilst you were at drama school, you took some elocution lessons to lose your Nottingham accent.
Yes.
And then when you met up with casting directors, they advised you to learn Arabic, Spanish and Greek, as they said you'd never be cast as an English gentleman.
They did.
Ironically, of course, later on you were cast as the seemingly aristocratic gentleman, Richard De Vere, who actually turned out to be a self-made Czechoslovakian millionaire. Does that make you laugh?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's strange, isn't it?
It is. Yes, I played quite a few foreign people. I think one of the earliest ones that I did on a film was The Yellow Rolls Royce. That would have been in about 1964, I think, when I played an Italian manager of a hotel, which they all went to. You know, Rex Harrison and everybody, all leads in that. Yes, it's true.
Yes.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's, and now I'm known for playing English people.
Yeah, that's a strange irony of life, I guess. But I mean,
yeah.
I mean, conversely, when it came to the now seminal piece of work, film work, Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, set in Nottingham, it must have been a positive advantage for you at that casting. Now, how did you feel seeing your flatmate and fellow drama student, Albert Finney from Salford, get the part?
Well, I love Albert. You know, having lived with him when we were at RADA, I'm very, very fond of Albert. And I know that he's a great actor. I knew he was a great actor then. I found it a bit frustrating to be told by Carol Rice, who directed it, to say, I'm sorry, I can't cast you in this, Peter. You'd be the only person with a genuine Nottingham accent. Because everybody else didn't. They were from, Albert's from Salford. Mm-hmm. And my great friend Brian Pringle, who was also in it, he's from up north somewhere.
Yeah.
I can't remember where, but somewhere up north.
Strange, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's the film business.
That's right. Now, of course, talking of the film business, you've certainly had a rich and varied career, as well as starring in films. When you started out, like so many actors, you also did a few stints as an extra. Indeed, you were an extra on films like On the Waterfront, which must have been a great experience, watching Brando in action.
No, I wasn't on the Waterfront.
Oh,
although, the fact that you've mentioned Marlon Brando... I discovered late in life that he was an enormous fan of mine, genuinely. And I do know from Michael Winner that he was very keen to meet me and have lunch with me. And then a year or two later, which was, I won't go into the reasons I didn't, I'll start crying. And then a few years later, I bumped into a very beautiful young woman who told me that Marlon Brando was a huge fan of mine, in case I didn't know, because she said, I'm his girl when he comes over to London, and he's got all your tapes of To the Manor Born and Rumpole of the Bailey and the Irish RM, and he watches them. He's a huge fan of yours.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
I'm thrilled.
Yes, that's a fantastic thing.
Yeah.
Now, plus,
I wasn't on the Waterfront. I was too young.
Of course you were. Now, of course, one of my previous guests, Anna Blackman, made me laugh when she said she split her trousers performing judo scenes in The Avengers. Mm-hmm. So they decided for more practicality to have leather trousers. So it wasn't obviously just for... sensationalism, but for practicality. But I never realised before reading your book that Patrick McNee had so much say on costume and design of that series. I mean, you appeared in several episodes.
Four.
Yes. How did you get on with him and the producers of this cult classic?
Oh, I got on with Patrick McNee extremely well. He was a lovely man, a real gentleman. Yes, he did. He told me that. It was straight from the horse's mouth. And I also knew the people who did all the stunts very well, because they were Doug Robinson was a great judo expert, and he did the fights. And he and his brother, then Joe, did many of the fights in the Bond pictures. And he was a world-level judo expert and wrestling man, and they taught me judo. Yes,
I understand. Yes, you do have judo skills yourself, enough to topple Brian Blessed, a former guest.
Yes, that's one of my great achievements in life.
Yeah. Yes. Couldn't have been easy, but you beat him to a brown belt grading.
I did.
How did you meet this shy, retiring man?
Well, I met him at the judo club, which I went to for about 4 or 5 years, and Brian and I became very friendly, and I got to know Brian extremely well. Funnily, the last time I saw him, was in Africa, and I was very naughtily going into a hotel which wasn't mine, because I was desperate for a pee, and as I crossed the foyer, this voice said, "Hello, Peter Bowles, you great puff," and I turned round, and it was Brian Blessed, who was about to go up Mount Kenya, and he'd been up Kilimanjaro, and that's when I discovered that he'd now become a mountaineer. But he was friendly enough, yes, to be able to shout that across the the foyer, knowing it wouldn't cause offence.
Absolutely. What better greeting could you wish from a former colleague?
Exactly.
Now, of course, you appeared in so many iconic and cult series, ranging from The Avengers to The Persuaders, with, of course, Roger Moore and Tony Curtis.
Yes.
What was it like working on that series?
Well, The Persuaders, I knew Roger Moore very well, and I got to know Tony Curtis too. I enjoyed them very much. In fact, a few years ago, when I was at the Ivy Club, I was actually I was actually with the director. Otherwise, I would have discussing something very important, which was putting on a play called Gangster Number One at the Alameda. I was with Jonathan Kent, and suddenly this voice shouted out. It wasn't "Hello, you big puff," but it was "Peter Bowles. What are you doing? How are you? I'm coming over," and it was Tony Curtis, and he came over with his girlfriend, who was wearing almost nothing, and he was hoping to sit down and you know, have a drink, but I just, you know, couldn't. I was trying to land this deal, but I was thrilled that he'd remembered me, because it was so many years later. But you see, the thing is, there's been an obituary for Mayor Koch recently, you know, the ex-mayor of New York. And I took my wife over to New York. She'd never been to New York. Sometime, I think, in the 80s. We were sitting in a restaurant, and there was a group of people, darkly clad. And they were all behaving in a manner which made me wonder if they were a mafia, because I'm English and watch gangster pictures, and because they were all paying great deference to a certain man and laughing at everything he said. And I turned to somebody at another table and very quietly said, "Who is that man over there?" And this man suddenly turned and stood and said, "You may not know who I am, Mr. Bowles, but I know who you are. My name is Koch. I'm the mayor of New York. Welcome to my city." And it turned out that he was a huge fan of the Irish RM. And indeed, it turned out that half of New York seemed to be. And it was very thrilling. I had no idea. I've been to New York several times, to America, on holiday and things. And I'm enormously flattered to discover that many of the shows that I've done have been shown over there, and seem to be continuously shown over there. And I have a lot of fans there.
That's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah, quite a lot of the listeners will be listening in to you today, a lot of them from America. Now, also, you've worked with the original star of, talking of Roger Moore there, the original star, James Bond, Sean Connery, in the Sidney Lumet film The Offence with Trevor Howard. Now, of course, Sean Connery went on to be cast as James Bond.
Yeah.
After playing a number of villains and being tall, dark and handsome yourself, did you ever have a hankering to play a Bond baddie or even 007 himself?
No. No, I didn't. No, it never crossed my mind. In those days, I didn't have the confidence. I never thought of myself as tall, dark, and handsome, and it's very nice for you to say that. I've never thought of myself in that way at all. No.
No, of course.
I didn't have that image of myself. No.
I'll let others have the image for you. Now, after hearing about Sean Connery landing Bond, you were also around when Peter O'Toole announced in the pub he got the part of Laurence Olivier.
That's right.
Did you have a hankering after epic parts? And what would you say
when
has been...
When he got the part of... When he got the part of... I'm sorry, you said...
Oh, Lawrence of Arabia.
Yes, Lawrence of Arabia.
What did I say? I said Laurence Olivier, didn't I?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Yes, I was. Yes, and it was very nice. I was at RADA with O'Toole. I was there with a very good bunch, Albert Finney and Alan Bates and Peter O'Toole, Brian Bedford, who you may not know, but he's a big star in America. Mm-hmm. And he came in and he put a wad of money on the bar and said, drinks on the house. I'll pay for everybody's drinks in a very nice way, because he's a very nice chap. Mm. And he just landed the part, yes.
Mm.
And he'd got his weekly expenses in his pocket, which was a lot of money.
Yes. Mm. It's a real epic moment, isn't
Actors
it?
Actors are like. Nice people, you know.
Oh, they are. They're very nice. The best in the world. Now, you've worked with a great many directors,
yes.
From Tony Richardson in charge of the Light Brigade, yes. to Sidney Lumet, we just mentioned.
And John Borman, too.
Oh, yes. Mm.
Yes.
And, of course, also Michael Winner approached you. How did you find them all, particularly Michael Winner, in their approach to actors?
Well, Michael Winner, I had this extraordinary experience sort of odd experience with Michael Winner. I got a call from my agent that Michael Winner wished to see me. I was doing a film, this is the one with Joe Brown, called Three Hats for Lisa at the time. I think he was playing a pop star, and I was his manager. I think that's right, which doesn't seem unreasonable at the time. And she said, Michael Winner wants to see you. And so on one of the days I wasn't working, we arranged a meeting, and I went to Michael Winner's, and I was met in a little office by a very pretty but seemingly very bored Sloaney-type young woman who said, what's your name? And I told her, and she said, oh, well, you sit there, and when this phone dings, or whatever it was, Mr. Winner will see you. So it dinged, and I went in. And when I went in, Mr. Winner, in my memory, didn't give me any greeting at all. He extended a fist towards me, an arm and a fist, and in this fist was a piece of paper. And he said, well, go on, take it. And it wasn't a handshake coming, it was a piece of paper. And I said, what's this? And he said, what does it look like? I said, well, it looks like a phone number. He said, yes, brilliant. It's exactly what it is. I went to go over to that desk over there and ring that number. I said, why? He said, because the reason that you're here is because the other person at the end of that line will be the person who said, I should meet you. He saw your rushes of a film that you're doing and thought you were brilliant and said, I should see you. So I want you to ring him and thank him very much indeed and tell him that you are now with Michael Winner. So it's very embarrassing. So anyway, I rang this man who was, I think, just as embarrassed as I was. And that's all I remember of the actual interview, except that when I went back out into the office, the young lady said, what did you think of Mr. Winner? Which rather surprised me, and I thought, this sounds a bit like a trap of some sort. I said, oh, he seems very nice. Nice, she said, nice. And then said something which, coming from her lips, rather surprised me. but it wasn't very flattering towards Michael, I must say. And that's what I remember. And I met him years and years later at some function, I told him this story, and I thought he'd laugh, but he didn't. He was quite upset and wanted to know the name of the girl. And I said, "But Michael, this is 40 years ago. You can't sack her now. She's probably a grandmother somewhere." And but he was quite upset.
Yes, he's
but
own,
then
yes.
he did try very hard to arrange a luncheon between myself and Marlon Brando. So.
Oh, anyway. He redeemed himself.
Yes.
Has his own inimitable way of doing things.
Yes, I never worked for him, actually.
The meeting was enough.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you also appeared in the 60s iconic film Blow Up with David Hemmings.
I did, yeah.
Now, we all know directors do like to act like they're God, but of course the director on Blow Up admitted he wasn't, but that he was quite close. What was your view on that?
Well, I loved everything about working on Blow Up. The extraordinary thing is I've always spoken my mind, or always, which has got me into, it probably held me back. But the thing that, apart from the joy of doing it and working with Antonioni, the thing that stands out really is that once I'd got the part, which I was thrilled to get, I had a most marvellous speech, which was actually the sort of the key to the film. And when I arrived to shoot this particular scene, which was a night scene, and we were shooting it at night, I was in makeup and I was handed some new sheets of paper, which isn't unusual in a film where they've been rewriting, you know. And I noticed that they'd cut that speech, and I wasn't distressed at all that my part had been changed. That didn't occur to me. What I was distressed about was that Antonioni had made a serious error in cutting it, or somebody had made a serious error. And I said so, and they said, "Well, you know, this is Antonioni. You know, he's written the script, and this is what he wants." And I said, "Well, he's wrong. He's made a mistake, and I must tell him." Anyway, to cut a longish story short, I was ushered into his presence, he was most polite, and said, "Peter, you have a problem, and tell me about it." And I told him why, you know, that this speech shouldn't be cut, and that he made a mistake, as politely as I could. And he said, "Peter, you are so clever. Of course, you are absolutely right. It is a very important speech, and that is why I have cut it. Because if I left the speech in, everyone would know what the film is about. If I take it out, they will think that this is a very interesting film. What is it about? Is it about this? Is it about that? Is it about..." He said it will become a very controversial film. And that is why I have cut it. And, of course, he was right, as it turned out, because nobody's quite sure what it is about, particularly the ending. But I know what it was about.
Yes, exactly. Doesn't help at the time when you're an actor with the speech involved, does it? But the overall picture, which is all what it's about, I guess.
Yes.
Now, of course, you said in your autobiography, which I found fascinating, that it was very good after playing villains to get to play some comedy. Now, the book has a subheading, An Actor's Life, and you certainly enjoyed a varied one. But I have to say, you played an actor to perfection when you starred as Hillary in an episode of Rising Damp.
Oh, yeah.
You stole every scene you were in. I really loved it.
Oh, that's nice.
Now, it couldn't have been easy to work with such perfectionists and comedy genius such as Leonard Rossiter. But what was he and Francis de La Tour like to work with?
Well, I hadn't worked with Francis de La Tour before. But she was wonderful to work with, and also lovely to be with, a delightful companion. I've always loved her and her work. Leonard, I knew and loved because I'd spent a year with him in at the Bristol Old Vic, where we, you know, were in 1959, I think. And so we knew each other very, very well. And so I found it very easy. Funny thing is that I was warned by everybody to be very careful with Leonard. You know, watch my P's and Q's, which I thought was odd, and because apparently he used to fly off the handle. But he certainly didn't with me, and I got on with him very well.
That's great stuff. Lovely to hear. Now, of course, very, very often certain actors and directors like to collaborate on many projects as they work well. But it seemed that you seemed to work with a master writer, Eric Chappell, on several occasions. Was that more luck than planning?
Well, I can't say I worked with him. I worked. I was lucky enough to have his scripts. The Bounder came out of. I was very naughty. My agent tells me I was extremely naughty. But because after I'd done three series of Only When I Laugh, they asked me to do a fourth. And I said I'd only do a fourth if I got my own series. And they thought that was pretty cheeky, or at least my agent did. Anyway, they said, have you got any ideas? And so I came up with one or two ideas. Which Eric kicked around, and then he came up with the idea of the Bounder. So that's as close as I got in that way. I mean, I have, as you would probably from reading my autobiography, been very much protagonist in creating a couple of series. Not comedy series, but drama series. But with Eric Chappell, they are absolutely his scripts. Nothing to do with me.
Oh, yes. It's a great
play. Writer.
Oh, absolutely.
Writer.
But the playing of them is so important.
Yes.
I just want to thank you for giving me some endless laughter on those hit shows like Only When I Laugh and Rising Damp. For talking of Only When I Laugh, I mean, did working... You're going to forgive the pun here, but did working with that cast make you H-A-P-P-Y?
Yes. What a good cast it was.
Mm.
Yes. And Richard Wilson, a late developer, but he doesn't know this. We never told him. But Jimmy Bolam and I were so impressed with Richard in that series. We knew he was a wonderful actor, comedy actor. We went to the heads of Yorkshire Television and said, you ought to give Richard his own series. You know, he's a wonderful actor. And they said, no, he is good, but he couldn't possibly carry his own series. He's not that good. Well, they got that wrong, didn't they?
Certainly did.
Yeah.
Yes, you had an insight in that, isn't it? That's very,
yes.
Very magnanimous and generous of you.
Well, we knew, because he used to moan a bit occasionally, we knew he was very frustrated in that he didn't have enough to do. And he was, I mean, apart from being an extremely intelligent man, he was brilliant.
Yes. You spotted the Victor Meldrew in the making there, didn't you? With
yes.
A bit of the moaning. Now, of course, talking of that, of hospitals, I mean, you worked in hospitals when you were a drama student. You also had a nurse's home near RADA. Did that give you a good insight for being in that comedy?
Well, I did work in a hospital twice. On for 8 weeks at a time, and I found I would have been 17 and 18, and it was very good for me in that I was working. The ward I was working in was a ward for incurable people, a male ward for incurables, and to make people laugh, as I was able to do. I don't know why, but I did. It was a great privilege to work in those wards, or in this particular ward. The dreadful thing, apart from the fact that these people were dying, was that in those days, children were not allowed. Children under the age of 12 were not allowed into the wards on visiting day. So, because some of the people who were terminally ill were youngish men, in their 30s and 40s. And their children would be brought to the windows to wave to Daddy, but they weren't allowed to come in. That's been changed many years now, but it was very touching.
I bet they were very glad to have you there as to lighten their spirits, of course. Now, of course, I mean, would you say you were anything like your character, Archie Glover, in the hit series?
No. I don't think I'm like that at all. I mean, I'm not at all like that, at all. It's a funny thing. I just, one of the oddest things in my life is that, Bill Nighy would like this, but there was rather a prejudice against me when I was young. Theatre was rather overtly left-wing thinking or leaning. I don't follow politics at all, really, but they were, and I know it was said by a very important and very influential director called Lindsay Anderson that he didn't think I was a proper actor because he'd seen me wear a suit. As I used to, I only had one suit, but I did like to wear it occasionally. And it rather upset him. It's funny, because he was from a much higher class than I was, as it turned out. But there we are. That's all in the past.
Yes, a lot of strange prejudices go on and very unfounded. And of course, when you're talking about Richard Wilson there having his height of fame sort of later in life, and Leonard Vosster actually came into acting, didn't he, later on after, I think, his insurance. But you really hit, would you say you really hit your height of popularity at that time, around about the 40, in your 40s?
Yeah, well, when I did To the Manor Born, I was 43. Mm-hmm. I did my first big leading role, my first leading role, in the theatre. I was 49 when I did The Entertainer. And so, yes, I'm a late developer. I remember when I was young, I thought I was always too tall to play leading roles. And I was too tall to play, when I say I wasn't too tall, I was too tall to play leading roles. I mean, I was too tall to play young men leading roles. Because I was always taller than the leading man. Just one of those things. So I put on a lot of weight deliberately and grew a moustache and tried to appear, as a character actor. A perfect example of that is me in The Charge of the Light Brigade, where I play Captain Dubley. A wonderful part, but I think I'm 14 and a half stone. And I'm 12 and a half now, and have been for many, many years. But I did deliberately put on weight and try to be, a character actor.
Very often, some of the more interesting parts come up later on in life as well, don't they? Which is wonderful for actors, because you can just go on and on and on.
Well, that is a wonderful thing.
It is, isn't it?
And also, you get better.
Yes, you gain more experience and... You see more of life and everything. So, yes. I mean, you've worked on so many different projects and have so many stories. I could talk to you all day. However, if people want to find out more and have more insights, I believe you're going to be appearing at the Rose Theatre in Kingston in their series called A Time to Talk.
Yes, Stephen Unwin's going to interview me. Mm. I was asked to write, apart from my autobiography, I was asked to write, which came out of the blue, by the publisher of Oberon Books, who it turned out was a fan of my theatre work. And he asked me to write a book, and so I have, which is called Behind the Curtain, The Job of Acting. Not on how to act or anything like that, I wouldn't dream of saying anything about that, but about what it is to be an actor, what it is, just, being an actor. So I've written that book. That's published last year. And I think Stephen's going to be talking to me about that, I think.
Fantastic. So that's Behind the Curtain.
Behind the Curtain.
Wonderful. Mm. Well, that's very useful, actually, because it is a completely different life, isn't it? And lots of different things that actors have to work with when they're away from the public eye. So,
yes, and it's surprising. Quite sophisticated people, you know, really quite sophisticated people, would come round backstage because to see me. And I've always been amazed that they've never been in a dressing room before, or, you know, they've probably seen films where they've seen Judy Garland's dressing room or something, which, of course, they're not real. It's like those marvelous nightclubs in films, which are always enormous. And I think they're quite surprised to see sometimes that the dressing rooms are really quite small and rather grotty. And I realise that they know nothing, really.
No.
About, I mean, it's like, how do you learn your lines type of thing.
Exactly. It's such a world that people don't know. Smokes and mirrors sometimes, isn't it? What goes on, and the reality and the fantasy.
And the naughtiness, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, of course, plenty of naughtiness. And of course, people can enjoy hearing you talk on the 26th of February, 5:30 p.m. So it should be a great event, and anyone who goes is going to be in for a really good time. So it just remains for me to wish you many happy hour talking at the event, and good luck with the book, and to thank you, Peter, for being on the show.
Thank you, and I'd just like to say that it's been an absolute delight talking to you and listening to your voice.
Oh, that's very kind of you. The feeling's mutual.
Okay.
And that was the talented actor of stage and screen, Peter Bowles. Brooklyn's Radio.